Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So last week, I put to you a question which was posed by, I can't remember who posed it, first of all, Jim Wilkinson.
Jim Wilkes.
Yeah.
Jim Wilkes.
Said which bands had never done cover versions? And you, I think very, very courageously, and I don't say that sarcastically in any way, you courageously nominated three, you know, because the old courageous thing is, you know, yes, Prime Minister, where Nigel Hawthorne says, that's very courageous, Prime Minister. And he goes, oh, it isn't, is it? It's the worst thing you can possibly...
Not a compliment.
Not a compliment.
Immediately feel undermined and insecure. I know.
Anyway, you proposed three. And who were they? Remind us, Mark.
Was it three? I think it might
have
been.
Yes, it was three.
It was certainly Genesis.
Yeah.
And it was certainly Queen.
Yeah.
Who was the third one? Wasn't it
Pink Floyd?
Pink Floyd.
And which I thought those are really good suggestions, and so inevitably there was some response from the massive out there
pointing out that I'm wrong about Queen.
Apparently, yes.
Queen used to do a version of Tutti Frutti, which I don't remember. But if you Google these things, there it is.
And so. they used to do also Shirley Bassey's Big Spender, which you can well imagine.
That's good.
You can well imagine. But obviously, you know, it was pretty marginal.
I don't pop my cork for that.
Yes, you really can see that. And I don't think anybody came up with anything that Genesis did, really. And everybody seems to agree that Pink Floyd just did Pink Floyd songs.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
But there have been other proposals, and I'll just whiz through them. Rooksby says the Velvet Underground. But apparently there are tapes of the Velvet Underground quite early on in their career doing Day Tripper by the Beatles.
God, that's bizarre.
Peter Briffer says Soft Machine. You're a bit of a Soft Machine head. Where do you stand on that?
And I can't remember them ever doing one. No, that's right. I don't think so.
Simon Cook.
And it seems very unlikely, doesn't it? Soft Machine, after playing a kind of 22-minute jazz rock instrumental, suddenly... charge into Dizzy Miss Lizzy. I don't know. Does it work?
Squeeze. Certainly done them rarely. They apparently did do a version of Blur's End of the Century on the B-side of a single of theirs. HMV says the Go-Betweens. He doesn't think the Go-Betweens did cover versions. This next one I'm very interested in, which really made me think. Paul Speed suggested this. The Police never did cover versions. Well, I'm certainly not aware of them
having done
a cover version, and which is really interesting when you consider that kind of certainly, well, all of them. They were all
pedigree.
Very experienced jamming musicians.
Exactly. They were all have played in bands that did cover versions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing that nothing found its way into their repertoire. John Walters asks King Crimson, did they do no cover versions? Certainly
That's
not
very
aware
unlikely,
of any.
Not aware of that.
And Will Birch asks, did ABBA never do a cover version? And somebody responded, apparently the only time they did any, Michael Svensson, who we must assume is from Sweden and therefore is more of an authority on ABBA than the rest of us, the only time they did any covers was on the B-side of Summer Night City. Then they did a medley of American folk songs. Somebody asked, did New Order never do cover versions? Somebody else, here's another good one. This is, again, Michael Svensson, actually. 10cc. Did 10cc ever do any cover versions?
Again, you can't think of four people more qualified who would have spent their entire lives, wouldn't they, the teenage lives in covers bands, you know. A good one was Ultravox. Did you see that one?
Oh, no, go on. Because
Ultravox never did, but then they did slip up at one point, did a version of King's Lead Hat by Eno.
Right.
So there is that one blot on their copy.
Right.
Yeah.
Michael Svensson again says, did Supertramp ever do a cover version? Well, you might be right, Michael. I'm not aware of them. Steely Dan, obviously. Simon Cooke says East St. Louis, Toodaloo. Yes, that's their cover version. Did Kraftwerk ever do a cover version?
That would seem wrong, wouldn't it, somehow? It would seem inappropriate.
But anyway, thanks for everybody's feedback on that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You're
saying, can you look up whether people have done cover versions or not? I don't think you really can. I think
because if you put in Joy Division and cover version, then obviously you get all the people who cover Joy Division songs. But I don't know what you can Google that tells you if they themselves covered somebody else's music. Hard to find out.
I think there possibly is the odd site, but it's not comprehensive information, is it? Because very often it's just tunes somebody played at a gig once, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not something that turned up on their album. Talking of which, did you see this campaign launched this week featuring Bjorn from ABBA?
Spokesman
for it. It's a campaign called Credits Due, which is being backed by various people in the music industry, including Spotify and Apple Music and the PRS for Music and the featured artists and all sorts of people. And it's basically to standardize and guarantee that every piece of newly recorded music is properly registered in the sense of, you know, who wrote it. You know, what's the title? Who played all this kind of stuff?
Producers.
And which seems entirely laudable to me. It seems like, I can see the reasons why the people in the industry want to do it, because obviously they want to keep track of their ownership and particularly as you get a fragmenting musical landscape, it's more and more difficult to keep track of that stuff.
Well, you're doing it principally to try and make sure that all the people involved who deserve money get the money.
Absolutely.
But beyond that, I thought it was interesting. I think he makes the point that, you know, when he was a kid, he used to listen to records looking at whatever, the gatefold sleeve. And as you did, you would look at the information about each track while listening to it. And I'm trying to think whether I would have, you know, my enjoyment of, you know, Kevin Ayers, Whatever She Brings, We Sing, was massively enhanced by knowing that Mike Oldfield was playing the bass and the guitar on one of the tracks. Now, had I not known that, I think I would have felt differently about it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely.
Let's say, you know, that Joni Mitchell and James Taylor were singing backing vocals on Tapestry. Knowing that and looking out for that really increased my enjoyment of the music. And the idea, obviously, is that if you just stream something, you're not going to get any of that information.
It so frustrating, on Apple Music or Spotify or whatever. You just get the name of the song and the name of the artist. And it's not enough.
It's simply not enough. No, it's not.
But it's funny. We were talking about this, I think, last night, that you and I are of the generation where we read music before we heard it. So you went in a record shop and you pored over the cover of whatever it was.
So when you eventually got around to hearing that song, you knew who'd produced it.
You knew
exactly
a lot about
where
it.
Where it was made. Yeah.
So my point is, can you, Mark Ellen, name the members, and now we haven't prepared this yet.
Oh God, I'm sure I won't be able to.
Bead of sweat has appeared on Mark Ellen's temple at this point. Can you name the members of the classic lineup of the Allman Brothers Band?
The Allman Brothers Band. J. Johanny Johansson, drums. Butch Trucks, drums. Barry Oakley, bass. Greg Allman, the keyboard. Dwayne Allman, slide guitar and guitar, and Dickie Betts guitar. That's the full six. So there we go.
That answers my question. I think you only know that because you grew up in the LP era.
Yeah.
And your relationship was as much with that 12-inch square piece of paper as it was with that record.
It was.
And so, you know, everything that was inside it, you learnt, you know.
Completely. You know. You would hear that person's instrumental contribution and be thinking about them and who it is who's making, who's actually responsible for it.
Yeah.
You know, all the every detail of that track you knew.
So, we're all in favour of Credits Due. I mean, the only shame is they're talking about this being a a change going forward, but it obviously won't involve things that were made 20, 30, 40 years ago, because that's the kind of information you want while you're listening to this music on a streaming service or wherever, isn't it? You want to be able to know who played on all these things and know who wrote all these things and have this stuff at your fingertips. It would be lovely to think that that the past would be filled in and at the same time as the future was taken care of.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
You know, we're always saying that it would be a good idea to have some T-shirts made with the slogan, play some old. You know, we've talked about doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it turns out...
To save you having to shout it all the time.
Yeah, it turns out we're slightly behind the curve here, actually, because an interview which appeared this week with the boss of BMG Record Company, he points out very interestingly, and this is particularly interesting because it's the same week, I think, that Universal Music is being floated on the New York Stock Exchange or wherever it's being floated. So, you know, investors' money is flowing into the music business. And what this guy points out is that in the streaming world, 70% of revenue is back catalog. It comes from people streaming what you might call old music rather than what you might call
new music. I read that and I couldn't work out what they meant by back. When does front catalog end and back catalog start? How old would that be? Is that four or five years or something?
No, I think it's probably more like the more useful way to look at it is it's not current chart material.
Yeah.
So, and the reason he was raising this point was that he's saying that investors are going to come into the music business having paid huge amounts of money for it, and then they crawl all over it, you know, and they're always looking for, you know, ways you can make more money or ways you could make it more efficiently or whatever. And the first question they're probably going to ask is, why does the music business spend the overwhelming majority of its money on front catalogue?
On creating new stuff.
Rather than back catalogue.
Because that's the point, is that you've got back catalogue.
Not just creating, promoting.
Yeah.
That's what costs the money. You know what I mean? And so...
Because back catalogue, you simply put it up and then make profit from it. Well, because it's already recorded. Front catalogue, you've got to pay for it to be manufactured in the first place, and then cross your fingers and pray that someone's going to earn you some profit out of it, presumably.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. You've dealt with it. I mean, music companies nowadays are different, but record companies, it was always the way. What were they always thinking about in record companies? They were thinking about what came out this week. That's all they were thinking about. They were thinking, you know, they would invariably, you know, approach you with massive enthusiasm about something we're really, really excited about. We think this band is so hot. They're really going to happen. They're going to take the world by storm. And, you know, we played this to the BBC and it's going to go on the A-list of Radio 1. And we think it's going to chart at, you know, number 35. And everybody wants a piece of this. And they're supporting so-and-so. And then crickets. Nothing would happen at all. And if you went back to them 3 weeks later and said, oh, by the way, that group, they go, well, what group? They completely forgot about that.
We moved on. We tried somebody else. We dropped them.
They moved on because it was always next Friday was always the key thing. Yeah, you know, that was where the intellectual and emotional focus of the music business was always on the new thing. Whereas now, you know, it used to be quite hard to sell people an old record. Probably quite hard because you had to persuade all the shops to stock it. You know. The average small record shop, and here we are going back into the mystery because we're talking about record shops. You know, what was a record shop full of when you went in, when you looked in the window? New stuff. What was near the door when you went in the shop? New stuff.
New stuff.
What was behind the counter when you went to the counter? New stuff. you know, and if they happen to have any old stuff, well, that you are very fortunate. You know, they happen to be well stocked and so forth. And novelty was a massive amount of what drove the music business. You know, the people think, have you heard the new so-and-so?
Completely. It's all news. It's what drove the music press.
The only people who say that nowadays are people in the music business. Nobody in the real world talks like that at all. Because, as I've said, till I'm blue in the mouth, we all have the same record collection.
We do. We all have. Is it 70 million tracks that are available on Spotify?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Do you know how many tracks are supposedly uploaded every day to Spotify? New tracks, 60,000.
There you go.
Which, if you work that out, that's 21 million tracks, new tracks a year.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is, why are people listening to music? A lot of the time they're making playlists, aren't they? So they're going on holiday. They're going on a flight, they're going on a train journey, it's a party or whatever. How much of that is likely to be new things that people are unfamiliar with? Not very much, because you don't want a challenge, do you?
You don't want to challenge.
You want to be challenged by saying, do I like this or not? You want to go for something you like. Hence the enormous success of people like Queen, you know, that people have just decided that they like Queen. They feel that Queen's music has some kind of recreational value.
But it's also not just people making playlists, it's people playing playlists that they haven't necessarily made, because it's just another way of programming music, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
They're made by commercial organizations or hobbyists or whatever, you know. I was telling you the other day, I was playing something on Spotify. I can't remember what it was, but it must have been something kind of country-ish or whatever. And it got to the end of I'd started playing the album. And it got to the end of it. And I was enjoying it. And I was working. It was just on in the background. And then it started playing another record. And normally I would think, oh, no, I want to hear something. You know, I don't want to have a dictator to me.
Don't try something new
on me.
Don't try that trick.
Don't try with me, mate.
You know how old I am. How dare you?
But anyway, I was quite enjoying this, and I listened a bit more. That was really good. And eventually, I went to the massive trouble of looking up at the screen to see what it was. That shows you how much work is involved in accessing music nowadays. I had to crane my chin up far enough to see what it was. It was by a group called the Cactus Blossoms. I think I mentioned them.
You said you sent me the things. Have a listen. They're really good. They sound like the Everly Brothers.
Really good.
They're really great.
Really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And but that's kind of how you find music, you know. And if anybody had told me they were new, I would have been horrified. I was sort of thinking they were 30, 40
tricked into
years.
It.
I was tricked into
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know? But no, I think it's an interesting point because. You know, the older stuff, you know, they clearly, if they get it to take with people, the rewards are absolutely huge. And Bob Levsetz, the American commentator, wrote about this, you know, this piece pointing out that majority of the value is in back catalog. And he said, nobody nowadays is as big as Queen. And I think
that's
it's
right.
Probably true.
Was the group you mentioned? That's right.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm even going to go a bit further. I'm going to ask you, Mark Allen, slightly controversial question. I've often said that after the Beatles, Queen are the most loved group in Britain. Okay, is it possible that they will overhaul them in time? Is that possible?
Oh God, that's fighting talk, isn't it? That's fighting talk. That's really unsettled me. That's ruined my day. I'm going to be worrying about that all day.
I'm not saying it's something I'd like to see or anything like that, but I can kind of imagine it.
Well, it's got that football stadium appeal.
It has.
It's got that air-punching thing that there's no Beatles. There's no Beatles track that can,
you can
that
punch
match
the air.
We Are the Champions in that respect.
There
unfortunately,
is
there's too nuanced. Too subtle.
It's so interesting, isn't it? The only Beatles tune that crowds would sing is Hey Jude, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's just meaningless. It's just nah, you know. There isn't one, is there? There's not another one. Crowds wouldn't sing All You Need Is Love.
No, they wouldn't.
Just wouldn't do it. Well, it's Queen. I've got loads of those kind of things, you know, that, that, you know, if you play in front of a crowd, the whole crowd responds in a way, you know, you wouldn't do the Beatles music. So unsettling though it might be, Mark, I put that.
I'm really thrown by that.
Okay. Don't worry, it won't happen tomorrow.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
You know, it's always nice to get feedback, Mark. And I got something from our mate Thomas Walsh in Dublin.
Oh, yeah.
Further to me talking the other week about having gone to see The Move and them not playing, them turning up on stage, not playing.
The world's greatest Move fan, in fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely, definitely. And he's found the bill for this show, and he sent it to me. So I'm going to read it to you, Mark. Okay.
Oh, go on, go on.
It's Mammoth All Night, spelt all N-I-T-E, of course, festival. Friday the 2nd of Feb, 1968, Queen's Hall, Leeds. Your host, Jimmy Savile. The Move. The Move, on. The Herd. Special guest stars from America, Chuck Berry and Edwin Starr.
That's a lot.
I suppose I must have. They must have played. I mean, I've seen Chuck Berry a couple of times before then. So maybe it was unremarkable by then. Chris Farlow and the Thunderbirds. I love Chris Farlow.
Yeah.
Julie Driscoll. Brian Auger.
He's
and the
still
Trinity.
My beating heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, Lord.
And then in the Where Are They Now file, Sammy Small, The Accent, and the Union Blues Rave Band. Tickets in advance, Mark, 16 shillings.
That's fantastic.
16 shillings. Tell the younger listeners how much that is in contemporary money.
16 shillings, well, 15 shillings would have been...
It's 80p, surely.
It's
80p. Or 20 shillings at the door. Not even a pound. 20 shillings. There you go. Catering through the night, morning breakfast. I have to say, most of the things promised on that bill did not appear.
I'm just already you're imagining a wonderful way. You queue up in your old particularly scented great coat, and there's a with your tray, and they're putting on you know, fried bread, you know, grilled tomatoes with that, mushroom, sausage, bacon.
No, I don't think so. Not for 16 shillings, mate.
Oh, good Lord.
You couldn't expect that. Anyway, it's lovely to hear from people.
And that was the bill where The Move didn't play.
No, The Move
they came on, they waved at you, and they went off again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, I was about to say something rather off colour there, but I won't.
I know what you were going to say something about probably the lucky lady that you went to the gig with. And now there was a snog in a bus stop on the way home. But no, you've thought better of it. And
oh, dear.
No wonder you didn't mention, remember Chuck Berry.
I'm a grandfather.
Yeah.
So, okay. Where were we? Yeah, so very often on Friday afternoons, because we're recording this on Saturday morning. Sometimes we do it Sunday morning, this time Saturday morning. Because Jim Hawkins, the cabin boy, is at sea. And so we have to do it Saturday morning. Anyway, and I often put out a request on Twitter on Friday afternoons and saying, any agenda items? We've got loads. Can I just say, if you're going to do this, do it in response to my thing on Fridays. And then it helps to keep the things together because people occasionally send me stuff during the week. And I'm sorry, I've completely forgotten about it.
It falls down a crack.
It does fall down a crack.
Like the sofa.
But we got loads of good ones here. Anything you'd like to start with, Mark?
Well, the favourite original soundtrack. Somebody was talking about that. I thought that was interesting. Because I'll tell you what mine is.
Somebody says most effective. Yeah, this is Paul Campion. I've got it here. Yeah, most effective use of a song in a movie. I'm going for just about anything on the Easy Rider soundtrack, he says. Fair enough. What were you going to say, Mark?
Well, the one I remember was The Graduate, because both you and I independently saw this, didn't we? You watched it.
It's on the BBC iPlayer right now.
My God, it's amazing.
It's extraordinary.
We watched it the other night. I thought it was fantastic. Don't make films like that anymore.
They don't.
What a weird... It's a weird combination between incredibly funny and incredibly bleak and sad at the same time.
It is.
I can't believe... Yeah, that film came out in 1967. And I couldn't believe, which is how many years ago, 54 years ago, I could still I haven't seen it since. I remember all the lines. Yeah. One word to you, Benjamin, plastics. Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce
me. Is his throat goes dry, as he says.
The bit where he's talking to Anne Bancroft. But interesting pop fact, he was 29 when he remained there. Anne Bancroft was 36. So she's only 7 years old.
So she was doing a thing that actors and actresses very rarely do, which is I'm going to play a bit older than me who's a sex bomb.
Yeah.
That's a kind of odd thing to do slightly.
Incredible. You know?
She was fantastic.
It's a bit where they're in bed and the whole thing about we don't talk anymore, you know, and he asks her about how her daughter Elaine was conceived, and he discovers that it was in a car. Now he wants to know what make of car. For God's sake, Benjamin, turn your light off. And stabbing out cigarettes angrily, you know. Eventually, just says, "Yeah, so old Elaine Benjamin got started in a Ford." He's just really made up by it.
So anyway, the music on the Graduate.
Oh, it's incredibly
really interesting because that happened quite by accident. Mike Nichols, who made The Graduate.
Yeah.
He was, while he was very, so often the music on films is decided by what they happen to be listening to when they're editing. And so when he was starting to edit The Graduate, I think his brother gave him a copy of Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, which was the Simon & Garfunkel record of the time. And he just played it. He just liked it. And so he'd hear it a lot when he was editing. And he'd think, no, he wants something like this is what we want. We want something a bit youthful, you know. So they got Simon & Garfunkel in and said, so what do you got? What do you got? And they played him two or three songs. And apparently
Mike Nichols didn't like him, did he?
Here's the interesting thing about Mike Nichols. God, I love Mike Nichols. Is he didn't go, oh, that's interesting, but he didn't quite hit the spot. He goes, well, that's no use. So imagine saying that to Simon & Garfunkel. That's just not very good at all. Have you not got anything better?
And so they were
slightly rocked back on their heels. And they said, well, there's a song here that we've been working on. We haven't entirely finished it. And started playing a song which they called Mrs. Roosevelt. Mrs.
Roosevelt, that's right, yeah.
And he said, you know, that's great. That's catchy. That's really good. But the only thing is you'll have to change it to Mrs. Robinson because that's the name of the character in the film. And what do they say? Did they take their bat home? Did they say, how dare you, sir? He said, yeah. It's already done.
Now I've been the recipient of this enormous check. Oh, it's so good. That film is so good. Also, interestingly, there's one song, it's Sound of Silence, I think, is played in its entirety twice. I can't think of that ever happening in a film before. The opening credit and later on. But, I mean, the album is fantastic. You've got April, you've got Sound of Silence, you've got Mrs. Robinson, you've got Scarborough Fair, and you've got those incredible instrumental sections by a guy called Dave Grusin.
Yeah, Dave Grusin.
And they're all kind of bossing over.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, there's bits party to accompany music. It's the bits to accompany the 21st birthday party.
It's incidental music.
It sounds like Austin Powers. It's absolutely amazing.
But that was what they did on films in those days, wasn't it?
They
used it was the soundtrack music. It wasn't just the music that happened to be pegged to the film. Anyway, J.J. Coleman says.
Should I just show you something I found? Yes,
oh, go on.
I'm trying to remember if we actually did this. And there it is. Look.
Oh, we're Nick Hayward.
We asked Nick Hayward. Can you see that?
Oh, I can.
Nick Hayward to
we reenacted
dress
the
up
cover.
And dress up as, on the cover of The Graduate.
We'll have to send that to him. That's fantastic.
Isn't that great?
I know. I wonder if he's got a copy of that. I've forgotten about that.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. J.J. Coleman is interested in band members who had no idea what the songs were about. He says he remembers Bernard Butler once expressed surprise when he learned what Brett Anderson's lyrics were actually saying. I wouldn't be surprised at all. I think I heard this in connection with Joy Division. I think it's on some documentary or something.
Oh, yes, they do.
By Joy
Division.
That when Ian Curtis killed himself, is only then that the members of the band listened to the words.
Realised what those songs were about. They just not really listened to them.
They just thought, really I just thought it was noise.
You know? Just, no, I just concentrated on my bass part, you know. Yes. I know, isn't that amazing?
Yes. So Stuart Penny,
the members of Yes are the ones. What do the members of Yes think when John Anderson was doing In and Around the Lake, Mountains Come Out of the Sky and They Stand There? I don't know. Yes. I mean, but you can take any random, drop a pin into any John Anderson lyric and be absolutely mystified, you know.
That's true. Yeah, when did Yes songs stop making sense? That's a good point. Mike Reed, I'm free associating here.
Yeah.
Mike Reed, the DJ, used to say that his favourite record of everything, I think I'm right saying this, was a Yes song, I think on the first album, called Survival, which is a kind of ecology song. I don't even remember the thing.
I don't remember that, no.
Everything that dies, dies for a reason, to put its strength into the season. You know, which is a bit flowery, but it kind of, there's a sense.
Well, there's a logic to it. Yeah. You know, it's got an obvious meaning, hasn't it?
It has, whereas after you know, following the Yes album, nothing.
Once you get to Fragile, it's just a weird, whimsical sensory impression, isn't it?
It's just word salad. Isn't
it? It is.
So yeah, there must have been other
cotton
groups.
Wool for brain.
There must have been other groups who thought that. And other questions. Do punk bands have a monopoly on silly band member names? Rat, Scabies, and Sensible being stellar examples. Well, it's not a monopoly, is it? Because surely members of Gong had mad names, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They did. They did. Submarine Captain Trish, wasn't it? God, what were they all called? Actually, young...
Well, there's somebody called something... there was a cheese reference in the name.
Oh, well, that's the name of the album, Camembert Electric.
Okay, yes. Sorry, I got it wrong. Okay, but there's also... I mean, there's Captain Beefheart's Magic Band, of course.
Beefheart's Magic Band.
Drumbo. The Mascara Snake. Antennae Jimmy Siemens. Come on, you can't do much better than that, can you? Beefheart itself.
The Poison Girls were good. Do you remember Poison Girls as in punk rock?
Oh,
yes. Poison Girls was Vice Subversa, Richard Famous, Belladonna, and Lance DeBoyle.
Well, that's punk rock.
That's not bad, is it?
But I suppose it came.
And the Burn the Bonzos, Rodney Rhino, Desborough Slater.
Yes.
Big Sid Nittles, Vernon
Dudley, Bo Hangnell.
Exactly. Thanks, Larry Smith. All good.
So Phil Turner says, it's Carl. Wow, is that true? It was Linda McCartney, when he sent this, it must have been yesterday, it was Linda McCartney's 80th birthday yesterday. Wow, that's something.
Wings, somebody said something about Wings.
Any views on Wings? Revival?
My view on Wings is, Wings, no one ever thought of Wings as a band. Did you?
No.
A band you'd like to join, a band you'd fantasize about, a band you'd wonder what they're all up to now. You just thought of them as a vehicle for Paul McCartney's music, didn't you?
Songs. I mean, he had some very good musicians in Wings, as well as some not so good musicians. You know, he had Denny Lane and people like that.
Yeah.
But I think it was a vehicle for Paul McCartney, and
I don't think there's any nostalgia for Wings as a concept.
I don't know. I think it might be different if you talk to a different generation. You know, it is interesting. You know what kind of love and respect there is for Paul McCartney post Beatles. There is a huge amount of it, and there's a huge amount of music there, you know. And it could be that's the kind of thing that that gets more famous years later, thanks to streaming. You know that it's there. You know that if you want to go and listen to London Town or Venus and Mars are All Right Tonight, well, there they are. Click. You know you can listen to them, and they probably sound, you know, quite contemporary and quite interesting, you know. So I think to be fair, they are worthy underrated. Yes,
Wings,
yeah,
hugely.
But it's
brilliant. There's a whole just years of fantastic songs. There was still a slightly snide attitude towards Beatles McCartney.
Yeah,
which as you say, no longer exists.
So, Mike Jones wants your suggestions for a crap Beatles songs compilation. He says he's never listened to a Beatles album. Okay. I
can give you some crap Beatles. There aren't many, but there are some. Dig a Pony. Dig it, Mr. Moonlight, Love Me Do. Sorry.
Yes, you're right.
Honey Pie.
Yesterday.
My feeling is, yeah.
I don't like it.
Like yesterday. Oh, my
not
God.
Not really.
The worst Beatles song, if you can call it a Beatles song, because it's only came out, I think, on one of the anthologies or whatever, was one called What's the New Mary Jane by John
Lennon. Oh, yes.
Absolutely awful. And you cannot believe. So that's how I'd kick off side one, anyway.
Yeah. It's funny. I was reading recently that the day that the Beatles had their pictures taken on the cover of Abbey Road, they were working on You Know My Name, Look Up the Number.
That's right, I know.
Which is the kind of most incoherent stone ramble.
Which I like, actually. I love it. Look at the slaggers.
They're playing the cabaret piano. On the day that they're putting the finishing touches to their most coherent statement, they are simultaneously making the most incoherent statement in the studio. Mike Gray says, I mentioned that nobody buys Rolling Stone magazine anymore. It turns out a print version of Rolling Stone is starting in the UK soon. Do you have any advice for them? Okay, here is my advice. Go and check that you've got a lot of money. Okay,
and that you're prepared to lose it.
Don't you think
that with music magazines, the only ones that seem to have any real value now is specialist ones? Don't you think? Like Mojo.
It certainly appears so, yeah.
Mojo's got, it only covers acts that people care very, very deeply about.
Yeah.
In incredible depth and detail. And therefore, you like Tom Waits, you like REM, but you may not particularly like Kraftwerk or Sly Stone or whatever, but you really approve of them being there. But the trouble with the Rolling Stones, it's got to cover the waterfront, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's got to reflect what's
popular. But also,
popular.
I've no idea how they're planning to distribute it or get it to people, because so much of it is it's like the it's like we say about the internet and music. Do you believe content is king? No, I don't believe content is king. Distribution is king. That's been proved in the last few years online, with everything. If you make something easy for people to get and they want it, they'll get it. If you try and drive them somewhere to go and get something, they won't do it at all.
Yeah.
And so magazines, and music magazines were a huge part of magazines, but they're not all magazines, flourished at a time when the average person on their way to work every day went in or past a newsagent and bought something. They possibly bought a newspaper. They bought a packet of cigarettes. They did whatever. And so there was, buying a magazine was a treat. People loved it. They loved doing it.
And really easy to do.
And now, just go and look at them. Go and look in your local, don't dare. I think now, Mark, after all this time.
Are you going to say, is W.H. Smith still there? There's one in my high road now. I've never seen a more decrepit-looking shop. It's hanging on by its
for years. There's a short digression here, actually. I think I've got readers, listeners. I'm going to share with you a trade secret. I think in the first issue of Q, Mark wrote a subscription strike.
I did. I can remember what it said. It said it was for subs. It said it was about the joy of getting the magazine posted to your doorstep. And it said it opened with the line: "Avoid the irksome hurly burly of your local magazine shop or whatever it was." And my God, they went mad. Quite rightly,
they did.
I thought it was just hilarious.
The sales department appeared at Mark's door, like, "What have you bloody done?"
Because
in those days, if the news trade took arms against you, you were really in trouble.
You were.
If W.H. Smith took umbrage, boy, you were in trouble.
Yeah.
Whereas now we can say, we don't care, And the more decrepit W.H. Smith is, the better, frankly. I don't care at all. But that's the problem. There used to be, news agents that were kind of churches of magazines, weren't they? You went in and bought them, and you were excited to buy them. And, what's Rolling Stone going to do? Stuff them in people's hands at tube stations. Not so much at the moment, I wouldn't have thought.
I don't think so.
And I can't see how it's going to happen.
I cannot work that out. Also, the attraction of Rolling Stone is you want the American perspective on things. Do you want the American perspective on what I imagine will be largely stuff that's popular in England? I don't know.
John Dredge, former Word Erratic guest. Good question, this. Why does it all have to be so terribly loud?
We're getting more and more middle-aged by the minute, aren't we?
But it's a fair point. Why does it all have to be so terribly loud? Because that's how it sounds best, really. Isn't that the truth, Mark? You know,
talking about the live music experience?
I think he is.
Because a lot of that's, if it's really loud, it's a more intimate experience. You're being that sensory bombardment gives you an illusion of pleasure, doesn't it? It's like if you go to a party and it's really loud music, it's more intimate because you've got to shout into people's ears to be heard. You know,
all right.
Brings people together.
Okay.
But also it's a way of convincing you you're having a good time. It's like the lights thing. The worse the album, the brighter the lights.
Yeah, true. Richard Dobson, an anniversary reissue has never, my lad, I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, has never improved an original album. Discuss.
A reissue? Well, it depends.
No, an anniversary reissue.
But that's mostly about outtakes, isn't it? Outtakes is the interesting thing.
You see, I think to answer your question, the simple one-word answer to your question, has it ever improved an original album? No.
No.
Not at all. Because what you've fallen in love with, if you bought a reissue, with some extra tracks. The reason you bought it is because you really liked the thing that you had before. And therefore, the other thing won't be better because it'll have something at the end of it which you didn't really want and they didn't want in the first place anyway. You wouldn't mind hearing it. That's fine if you could just go online and listen to a track that didn't get on your favorite record. That's perfectly fine. But to be provided with the record, here's a record you really like. Here it is with some extra stuff. Ooh, I don't know. It's like, here's a meal you really like. Here it is with more vegetables. No.
Here's a painting you really like, but somebody in the background's had a moustache painted on them.
I can see why the record business do it. I can see why we buy it. But no, it doesn't make it any better at all. Mark Piper wants to know, and I fear we've answered this question many times, what's the loudest gig you've ever been to?
Oh, we've done this. You and I were at the same one, both of them, and they were. Blur at the Astoria. Oh, my God, I'm still in pain. God. Do you remember that? The sense that a 10-ton truck was driving over your ribcage. And the other was the KLF at the Brit Awards.
Oh, God.
My Lord.
Oh,
I mean, it was just absolute terrible. People were leaving. Who was the classical composer?
The great conductor, Sir George Sholte.
Sholte, that's right, yeah.
He went past me running. I'm not joking. And he was an elderly gentleman at that stage, running towards the exit, holding his ears. Because basically, if you're Sir George Sholte, your hearing is your livelihood.
That's your entire livelihood. And there's Bill Drummond on stage with a machine gun. Do you remember? That's how they started the set, was with an absolutely deafening round of machine gun fire. Oh, my God.
Oh, dear.
Go on. What else is there?
So this is interesting. David Poole, when the band you love goes bad, does anybody ever really abandon them? You know, it's basically saying, can bands ever be cancelled? It says, you know, in the case of the Smiths, no records appear to have been burned. In the case of the Stone Roses, no records appear to be burned. He says,
Why would the Stone Roses be cancelled? Just because Ian Brown's being an idiot. That's what it is. Same with Morrissey.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Really?
Lost profits are probably cancelled, aren't they? Without getting into any detail. I don't know if that's something that really kind of exists. But I don't know. The Smiths, I mean, they're popularity on the slide, certainly. But you know.
I wonder if anybody's streaming the Smiths on Spotify and so forth without having to go and buy a record by the Smiths. Do people still like to listen to them?
But also, it is possible to divorce yours, to separate, the unwise comments of the lead singer in this day and age with the music, isn't it? I mean, you don't have to associate the two.
No, that's true. So anyway, it's very nice to have people's questions. It's very nice to, keep the bright red ball of conversation in the air. Anything further you'd like to mention this week, Mark?
Oh, we should mention Keith.
Keith Adsley,
who's a great supporter of us. Keith, who's always on the quiz. In fact, we were talking to him last night at the weekly quiz, and Keith trademark a luxurious beard, a beard rivaled only by kind of Paddy McAloon or Leonardo da Vinci or W.G. Grace.
If you've got a copy of Sir Henriot Rawlinson M.
That's right.
Go and look at that. Hold that in front of you now. That is what Keith looks
like. That's what Keith looks like. He's very, very...
looks like. But that's going to change, Mark.
Well, Keith is a... I'm just looking at a little news thing here about his charity fundraising effort. He says, a popular figure on St. Albans Charter Market for over 44 years, he has pledged to shave off his beard to support a new recovery home set up in the city. The bid by Keith Adsley of Eat Whole Foods is one of many fundraising events being led by local residents. And Keith is saying that if he raises £1,000, he's going to have his beard, his substantial beard, shaved off.
It's going to be in the market square. That's where we were joking. It's probably the place, in the past where people were whipped.
That's right. Yeah.
Put in the stocks.
Nowadays, by their toenails.
Nowadays, it's people having their beards removed for charity.
Keith says that this beard is a natural heritage site equal to St. Albans Abbey. That's really good. we'll put a little link to this.
So if you support a good cause and also, hold out the possibility that we may one day glimpse, ladies and gentlemen, the chin of Keith Adsley.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.